Hello and welcome to The Bagel Bite with me, Hayden Cohen. This is the second in our LGBT interview series, but before we get on to that, I wanted to share a couple of responses from the first LGBT episode. I received an email from one of the subscribers to the newsletter saying the following: how low, sick and disgusting to associate anything Jewish with these disturbed freaks. They should be ignored, not given any credence. Very shameful of you to entertain them. I was sad to see their lack of empathy, so I responded. And I'm not going to stop. The primary directive of Judaism is to be a mensch, a good person. You have just committed a chilul Hashem, a crime against God. Any God who would call anyone a disturbed freak is a God I reject. Thank you for listening. Suffice to say, they unsubscribed from the mailing list, as did one of their friends. If you would like to balance out their hatred and receive notifications of new episodes, a chance to give your input to the show, and be in with a shot at winning some prizes in the very near future, sign up at bagelpodcast.com. Does this mean I'm now exploiting the LGBT community like so many businesses? Well, at least the bagel logo isn't a rainbow. Best not to think too much about it. To balance out this hate, an Orthodox rabbi got in touch with me to say that during Simchat Torah, the festival where we celebrate the annual cycle of the reading of the Torah, every male gets called up for an aliyah. Let's not get into the quagmire of why not women, that's a broigus for another day, but there was an individual in attendance at their shul, their Orthodox shul, who was a transgender man. And this rabbi gave them an aliyah because it was the decent thing to do to make the service as inclusive as possible. Even better, our next guest helped to provide the Orthodox religious framework to make this happen, even if the chief rabbi doesn't allow it. Yet. Times are a-changing. Rabbi Mike Moskowitz is a true mensch. As an Orthodox rabbi, he advocates for the rights of the transgender Jewish community, and luckily for me, he is both earnest and has a great sense of humour. Hope you enjoy.
I suppose what I'd like to know is your story, right? So how have you come to be sat here in the finest seat in the world, here on the Bagel Podcast?
That's such a wonderful question. I was just lucky, I suppose. Not everybody can sit in this chair at this moment. It's been a journey. There's a way in which, for me, it feels very linear, that at 17, I came out as Orthodox and was motivated.
You love saying that. Like how many times a day do you do that line?
Because I think there are lessons to learn that even academics don't appreciate the born this way mentality, right? Because it minimizes a lot. But within the Jewish world, we recognize that there's tremendous space for growth and evolution. A person can be assigned not Jewish and say, like, I feel Jewish and I really want to be Jewish. And we say, fantastic, there's some paperwork, you'll go to the mikvah, whatever, we'll make it happen. But nobody's saying, well, no, you don't understand, you're fixed. You're born this way, and so, like, you have to die that way. It's just not a Jewish value. We find this throughout our tradition, that sometimes there could be a perceived contradiction between the physical and the spiritual, especially here where the day is so short, right? In the winter, it's like there's like no daylight. It's amazing, right? But in the reverse, where like Shabbos could start 10 o'clock at night and you want to have, so you can take in Shabbos early, right? But the sun's out, but it's Shabbos. So how come we're not saying, I don't understand. How can you tell me that it's Shabbos? I see the sun. We're not bothered by that. So I think by talking about, you know, being assigned secular, coming out as Orthodox, right? There's a way in which it elevates the speech, the language, and also lets it be much more relatable that we're all trying to figure out who we are in relationship with God and want to be present in the most authentic and genuine space. So for me at 17, trying to find meaning and purpose, and there's so much pain and suffering in the world. There is so much pain and suffering in the world. So why are we all here and why is it worth it? None of us get out of it alive. And so trying to kind of see that darkness as an invitation to be the light and do something about it put me on the journey in the right-wing trajectory to go to yeshiva. I learned in Lakewood in New Jersey, in the Mirror in Jerusalem for about a decade. And then 20 years later, at 37, I was a rabbi at Columbia University. I was the rabbi of the Old Broadway Synagogue in Harlem.
I just kind of want to go back a bit because I feel like you've skipped. Do you know what I mean? Like, I've had the same conversations in my head, right? In terms of, you know, when I was a teenager, and you have probably very similar conversations to you had with yourself, right?
Yeah.
but I'm not here with a rabbi, you know, the black beard and the black hat, right?
Right.
Those thoughts could have manifested themselves in a million different ways.
Yeah.
Why was becoming from and Orthodox from, why was that the decision for you?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think the open-mindedness to explore it and the willingness to sacrifice the first 17 years, right? I was supposed to go to college and then go to law school, and my father's a doctor. And there was like a very natural progression of what everybody else was doing from just being passive. And I think for me, being able to say, but one second, maybe that's not what I'm supposed to be doing just because everybody else is doing it. I wanted to align myself and affiliate and associate with those who were taking the thing that I thought was the most important the most seriously. And so for me in that moment, it meant like, I need to go to yeshiva. And I need to learn it all. I know nothing. And so, you know, when I finally got there to yeshiva, not really knowing even all the letters of the Hebrew alphabet, I realized that if I was going to take this seriously, and for me at the moment, it felt like being alive in relationship with God and answering this question of what does God want from me right now required access to information that I could not rely on somebody else to be able to provide. And so I decided like, okay, so I'm not going to go to college. I'm going to go to yeshiva. And so like, I'm signing for 4 years. And once I'm going to sign up for 4 years, then I actually need to make a profession out of it, because how can I justify investing so much time in that? And so I went.
It was literally that quick. It was literally. Yeah.
In that moment, I'll tell you where I was. I was in West Virginia. The background is that I was dating a girl in high school who's not Jewish, a wonderful woman of color. Some people in my family weren't thrilled and thought that I should meet some nice Jewish girls. And so they set me up to go to USY, the conservative movement's youth group, just as a way of dating somebody Jewish. And it worked. I met a lovely Jewish girl who's now a woman and happily married, I think still somewhere in that area. And at a Shabbaton in West Virginia, in USY, she was part of this Abraham Joshua Heschel Honor Society. I wasn't cool enough to be in it. So there was a moment where I was waiting outside of this thing. She was in there. There was nothing to do or read. There was no such thing as cell phones at the time. But there was a sitter. And in the sitter, the Sim Shalom sitter, they had Pirkei Avos, right? Ethics of Our Fathers. And so I started reading it. And it was literally a moment where it was like, oh, right. This world's really broken and we're supposed to do something about it. And like, that's why we're here. We're here to partner with God to make the world better.
But why not like work for a charity?
Yeah. I guess at 17, I was really idealistic and I was just like, yeah, of course. Like, duh. Like, good. So I'm now going to go on a different path. And ironically broke up with her because I really, you know.
She wasn't from enough.
She wasn't from enough. That's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. She was not thrilled. She was not thrilled.
I found someone else. God.
That's right. I'm going to be walking long walks with God in the park these days. Candlelight dinners. You know how it is. Friday night. So, yeah. And so that was it. And I really, like, for 20 years, went all in that world, doing all the things that you're supposed to do. Had wonderful teachers. It was lonely because culturally it wasn't my world. I saw it very much as a means to an end. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life after. Like, did I want to become the head of a yeshiva? Did I want to have a synagogue? Did I want to go into Jewish outreach or like to become like a rabbi that does education? It wasn't clear at all. And I obsessed about it. Like, what should I do? Because if I want to do this, then I should try to study this. And never could have imagined that this is where I was going to end up. But thank God, you know, studying the Talmud before I left yeshiva and really having the privilege to be in the company of amazing people. And then at 37, I felt like the same sensation that I felt at 17. Like, what am I doing? Why am I here? What does God want from me? And I think that same open-mindedness allowed me to then like, again, say, okay, so it's going to look really different and I don't know what it's going to look like and there are going to be consequences, but it ended well when I did it at 17 and this will end well because I feel like I'm on a path.
So what was that change?
So I started getting involved in trans advocacy when someone in my own family transitioned and I had no idea what or how to be supportive. I didn't know what that meant. Somebody said to me, I'm not a girl, I'm a boy. And I said, well, I know how I'm a boy. How do you know that you're a boy? It's not the same way. And the person said, no, I just am. And I wanted to be supportive and had no idea how to do it. I reached out to my rabbis, really wonderful people who also were like, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. Like, never gotten this question before, but it doesn't sound like, you know, like it's healthy was basically the approach. I reached out to the gender studies department at Columbia, met a wonderful group of academics and trans folks and then trans Jews. And then my synagogue started to attract more trans Jews that knew that it was a safe space. And about a year into it, I was writing for Keshet, which is in America out of Boston, an LGBT Jewish organization. I was writing under a pseudonym.
There's Keshet in the UK as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if they're connected or not, but the rainbow in Hebrew was a popular, right?
Well, I think what I'd just like to say just before you go on, I just kind of, because I was thinking, but I knew this was coming and that, yeah, this is your topic. Just for the listeners, basically, sure. in that I think there's an acknowledgement that we kind of have to make here that we are two straight white guys.
Cisgender. Yeah.
Talking about this topic. I as a kind of the host, acknowledge that there could be a potential, you know, issue with that. I'm acknowledging it is the elephant in the room, but at the same time, we can talk about these things. And anybody else, if anybody's listening to this who wants to be represented and isn't, I'm always up for having those interviews and those discussions, and I'm open to that 100%. And I just don't want it to feel like it's two blokes talking about this.
Absolutely. It's awkward.
Yeah.
It's absolutely awkward. And it's something that I deal with every single day. I'm the scholar in residence for trans and queer Jewish studies at the world's largest LGBT synagogue in New York City, CBSD. And I'm not trans, nor am I queer. And for me, it feels less awkward to be silent. I'm sorry, right. It feels, in other words, this awkwardness is awkward, but it's less awkward than the awkwardness of being silent, because the world's broken. And allyship is predicated on the reality that the world is broken. If we could see each other as equals, then we wouldn't need to stand up for each other. So right. The goal of all of this advocacy work and allyship work, which is how I identify as an ally, is to become as obsolete as quickly as possible. That because of my education in right-wing Lithuanian yeshivas, there isn't a trans man that could have this position that I have, because they're not allowed in yeshivas. And also, women don't get the education in that world. And so the scholarship piece is the piece that allows me to do this work without that guilt. We're hosting a conference, the first ever trans Jewish convening of its type, and it's all trans-led. And so part of the role of the ally is to amplify the voice of that first person narrative and to give more visibility and more exposure. And so I'm so happy that you're going to have hopefully trans folks on, and would very much like to stay in my lane of allyship and the voice of a family member of somebody who's trans, and also the rabbinic voice. And so those are voices that feel very authentic to me, and bringing awareness to these issues with these topics within the Jewish world, I think, is really important. And for the trans and gender nonconforming folks who are listening, know that we see you, we love you, we want to hear from you. There is space. For sure. God does not put extra people in this world. God does not make mistakes. And God willing, one of you will have my job soon.
And I'd also like to say that the Bagel podcast has no editorial oversight from anyone other than me. And my decision on that is, I want to hear your voice. I want to hear what you have to say. So I just wanted to ask, what does the Torah say about trans?
Beautiful. So what's really interesting is that I think since the creation of people, there hasn't been a day that was free from the trans experience. The very first person to transition was Adam, was made in the image of God, and then transitions from being Adam to being Ish v'Isha, man and woman.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
And that's true, right? Yeah. Rashi even says, the medieval commentator, that we see that God created this world through the Hebrew language, because etymologically, the word for man and woman, Ish and Isha, are related, because physically they're related, that one came from the other. And I understand it as Adam being in the image of God. In our tradition, God is very gendered in terms of attributes, our father, our king, and also in the feminine. But God doesn't have a body. So where does gender lie? It's an important question, and I don't know that we have the answer to it. But if it exists on a soul level, which I think it does, it can give us new opportunities to have conversations about gender-based spiritual practice. And also, we could recognize that Adam and Eve were kind of the binaries of the poles of masculine and feminine, and we all have blending unique aspects of all of the different souls. And so for some of us, we feel tension in the way in which our body presents, the way in which we're assigned, and the way in which we're able to kind of experience gender, and for some of us don't, and for some people there's no tension, we transition in all of the different manifestations. But for me, I think that what the Torah says, more importantly than that meta question of where gender lies, is how we as a community have a responsibility to support individuals to make sure that there's a safe space.
Do you find, though, that, you know, if you say take the traditional rabbinic line of things like, say, go forth and multiply, right? Mm-hmm. And that can be an issue, and you know, I would imagine, especially in, say, the really orthodox communities, that can be a serious issue, right? Because that's kind of the driving force. How are issues like that dealt? How would you deal with those?
It's a great question. So just to clarify for the listeners, gender identity and sexual orientation obviously are different. Someone who's asexual is not free from gender. So if you, let's say you have a trans man marrying a trans woman, right, that still supports a heteronormative space and people can still conceive. And in fact, in America now, there's a shift around language, away from language of like feminine hygiene products, because there's some trans men that need them, right? And so the work that I do is trying to separate out the homophobia and the transphobia from within Orthodoxy, because I don't think that God is a misogynist and I don't think that God is, right, homophobic or transphobic. And we're all in a relationship with God, and each one of us needs to ask, like, what does God want from me? And we each have access to all that information. So for the trans experience to be seen, there needs to be a recognition that men and women are different in some way, or else there's no space to transition. That being said, there's a lot in the world that's toxic masculinity, that's patriarchy, that's not part of our tradition, that's misogyny. And so we need to separate out the things which are true to gender and not just the social construction. And it's tricky. So,
But did you also bring in all the, you know, what seems to be talked about more and more about non-gendered? And that kind of adds another layer of complexity to it.
Absolutely. And, you know, every Shemona Esrei, every prayer that we offer starts with at least five gods. My God, the God of my ancestors, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac and Jacob, and some add. So there's a recognition that there's only one God, and we're each at different moments in a different type of relationship. For some people, their God is a gender-neutral God. Of course my God's not gendered. For me personally, my God is an all-gender God. And so, like, that's up to the individual. And I think that but
is it? So if you open up a Siddur prayer book, you know, right, Chumash, anything, it's he,
right,
talking about God. It's never she, it's never it, it's never them. You know, the pronoun is he.
Very often, and it certainly speaks to certain aspects of God. There are other ones like the Shekhinah, which are very feminine. When we talk about God as the Baal HaRachamim, the merciful one, the word there is the root there is Rechem, womb, the one who gave birth. HaMakom, the omnipresent, which is also the consoling one. Makom is a euphemism for the female anatomy, right? The birth of a nation, right, is a very feminine part of the Exodus of Egypt, which is that Yetziah, the going out of Mitzrayim, this language of narrowness like the birth canal. So I think that, you know, the root of the word Emunah, faith, comes from that word Aim, mother. So there, again, I think there are aspects which are part of our, like, the vengeful, wrathful God on some level exists so that we don't have to be vengeful and wrathful because God's going to take care of it, right? God can be the judge, so I don't have to, right? And so in that way, they're masculine components. But, you know, and I think when I first got to yeshiva, mine was a do this or burn type God. And through, you know, the last 20 some years, mine is a much more compassionate, nurturing, forgiving, you know, comforting, you're doing the very best you can type God.
So how do you reconcile that? So I know, like, for example, I've always, well, not always, but recently come to this conclusion that if God is a homophobic God, that is not a God I want to believe in. But then I have the freedom to do that because I'm not a rabbi. Right, right. So I can effectively say what I want, you know. And in fact, there is a session I do called the Philosophy of Cherry Picking about, you know, how and why we choose what we do. But I have that freedom, whereas you don't to a certain extent, you know, because when you are an Orthodox rabbi, there's a certain list of things that you have to tick off. And I'm sure, you know, not to put words in your mouth, I'm sure there's certain things that you have massive difficulties with. But I don't have to reconcile those in a way because I am a cherry-picking Jew. I don't have to. How do you reconcile those issues?
It's a great question. I think that there's an objective and absolute truth about God in that either God exists or God doesn't exist, and it's certainly not going to be dependent on my belief, right? So either God is homophobic or God isn't, and it doesn't make a difference how many articles I write or how I reframe it, right? How many speeches, either God is or God isn't. I don't believe that God is. And I think that...
Why?
I guess on some level we have to define terms. There was just an incident in America with an Orthodox lesbian comedian that got thrown out of a canceled thing. So in response, so a wonderful woman, Leah Forster, is a comedian, and she had booked a venue that had a hashgacha, rabbinic supervision over the kashrus. And allegedly, the kashrus organization told the venue that if you allow her to perform here, we're going to take away your certification.
Is that still allegedly, or has that been...
I think it's under investigation.
Okay, fine, fine, fine. Allegedly. Thank you. I appreciate it.
You don't need the... And so in response, I pointed out in a speech that if anything, the Torah is heterophobic, right? The prohibitions that the Torah has for single, you know, for men and women not to be alone together, lest something happens, or even non-sexual platonic touch, lest something happens, right? We don't find that. So I think if there are lines that the Torah has drawn to help guide us in a path to be in a healthy relationship with God, there's a different set of lines that humans have drawn to make us feel more comfortable about who we are, right? And so I think one of the questions that we need to ask, and I'm happy to send you the speech. I give examples, right? In other words, for example, you know, if you're willing to say good Shabbos to somebody as they get out of their car Saturday morning, but you're not willing to, even though their Shabbos is a different Shabbos than yours, but you're not willing to say Mazel Tov to two men, even though that their marriage is a different marriage. Like, why can you say Shabbos and not Mazel Tov? Or even if, let's say, it's a heteronormative couple and they're living together, right? So you have no problem saying Mazel Tov to them, even though maybe she's not going to the mikvah, or like she's not doing, they're not doing the things that you would expect in an Orthodox space. And that's our own homophobia that has nothing to do with God.
Right.
So I think...
Because was it like, is there a priority list? Is there an order of mitzvot of, you know, good deeds? Is there a hierarchy, a top trumps?
So what's interesting is that, you know, the Talmud often asks, you know, so if you have to distill down to like one mitzvah, what's the mitzvah, right? And there's all these different conversations. Allowing people, like not being a jerk is essentially what it all boils down to, right? Don't be a jerk. So whether it's in the positive, it's in the negative, you know, we all do the very best we can, and everybody struggles in different ways. For some people who are gay, what they think that that verse says to them and the space that they exist in is one of the struggle for celibacy that for them feels like the holiest place. And they wouldn't want someone to come along and say, you know what, no, it's all good. You can do whatever you want. Because for them, their identity is in walking with God as in that space of tension. For other people with the exact same verse, right, interpret and say, no, that's, it's framed in a heteronormative space, that if a guy is normally with men, he shouldn't also be with women, right? Because it's not cool to misrepresent oneself. And there are others that do other things to the verses, and other people have different traditions of what it means.
Can I say, as a rabbi, mm-hmm. is there a part of you that kind of wishes that more people would obsess about other phrases as much as they obsess about that one?
Yes, and I think that one of the great examples is about speaking Lashon Hara, not speaking bad, you know, badly bad people. So, right, there are 36 different
verses. However fun it might be.
However, that's right. So in America, and it might have even made it here, there was an organization, it was called the Chafetz Chaim Heritage Foundation, and they had this initiative to take 1 hour a day and not speak badly. And I remember growing up, people would be like, oh, no, you got to save it. This is my hour. And it's just so strange. So we used to joke, you know, that better...
Was that a serious
that
thing?
That was a serious thing.
So everyone was that horrible about everybody else. They even 1 hour.
It was a struggle. And then people would take 1 hour and be like, no, my hour is going to be like 3 to 4 in the morning, right? So we used to joke, better to take 1 hour, right? My initiative is going to be 23 times better. I'm going to take 1 hour and I'm going to speak all the Lashon Hara. And then for the other 23, I'm going to be a tzaddik, right? So we can joke about it, right? Because we all do it, right? So we don't have to feel embarrassed about speaking badly because we all speak Lashon Hara. But could you imagine if a person had a sweatshirt that said, no, this is my hour not to have gay sex, right? Like, you couldn't do that. But like, well, I don't understand. This is one, this is 36. So no, okay, but this is what I do and I don't want like to feel bad. And we can't say that you can do it for 1 hour because you're not supposed to do it. So there are a lot of examples where we have, you know, and it's not new. Abraham.
It just reminded me of one. I was in Shul on Rosh Hashanah, the synagogue Rosh Hashanah, and the rabbi did this sermon about when your one step family member dies, that you're not bound by the laws of halacha. So, and I know it's all about positive commandments rather than negative, but I did joke to my mum on the way out. I went, look, in the 50, you know, 100 years when you pass, and I will be beyond sad. I've heard pork cracklings rather nice. she wasn't impressed.
Wasn't impressed. Yeah. I get that. So yes. You know, we all look, I think, for opportunities to fulfill things that we feel constricted, because in our relationship with God, there's an ask. God has expectations, and sometimes they're difficult. But if we really want people to be in an authentic and genuine relationship with God, we need to give people the space to make those choices. But this struggle of like justifying the lines that we draw, and we all draw lines, is not new. Abraham tells Sarah, when he's going to go to the king, tell them that you're my sister, because if we tell them that you're my wife, they're going to kill you. They'll kill me. So it's very strange that they were particular about adultery, but they weren't particular about murder, right? So those are like some squiggly lines. And they also just said it in the name of God that, no, how could you not tell us we're holy people, right? There were holy people who were going to kill, right, in order not to commit adultery. So that's just part of the human experience. We all draw lines, right? And so I think naming the fact that we've made homophobia and not God, that's a social construction. What are you afraid? I work in the world's largest LGBT synagogue. It's a queer space. There's glitter in my beard periodically. It doesn't come out very easily. It's an amazing group of people, and it's a mixture between queer and straight folks. But I'm surrounded by queer people all day. I am as straight now as I was in high school, and it's just not something that we need to be afraid of. People are who they are, and they get to choose what they want to do with that, and that's something that we need to respect.
So can I, are you part of any sect or part of you, and to kind of follow on from that, how do your rabbinic colleagues react to your chosen focus at the moment?
It's a great question. So I identify as yeshivish, meaning that I feel that that group of people most naturally align in the way in which I see the world in terms of the devotion to learning and to spiritual practice. I think it's a little too inwardly focused and needs to be a little bit more focused in spreading that light to the universe. There's a mixture of people who are really in opposition, particularly... there are some who are very much in opposition. I like...
chicken, I'm calling you out.
Okay, so it's interesting how, like, who feels so motivated. There's a term in America, the alt-right. So the alt-right is not a big fan of me. They call me, you know, fake Orthodox and fake rabbi and these things. Within mainstream centrist Orthodoxy...
I think you should get t-shirts, get a badge. That's a badge of honor, honor. So.
No, it's true. You know, somebody from the Orthodox Union wrote... I don't know that he was representing the Orthodox Union when he did this, but somebody who's affiliated with it wrote an article against me and some other fine Jews, Seth Farber and Dasi Fruchter and some wonderful people, and said that I... advocate for cross-dressing in illicit relationships. Now, anyone who's familiar with any of this knows that, like, wearing misgender clothing exists independent of any sort of relationship, illicit or others, and gender identity. So it becomes a way to have a national conversation. So I gave a speech after, and it's out there in the Facebook world, in the internet. But naming that you can't answer a question until you know the reality. And so, like, if you've never met a trans person, right, and you don't understand how these things are two separate tracks, right, so then you're just showing your ignorance in the opposition. Within mainstream centrist Orthodoxy, I think everybody acknowledges that the rabbis have been horrifically negligent, like on a malpractice level. The standard response to a guy who comes to his rabbi and says, "Rabbi, you don't understand, like, I'm attracted to men, I'm not attracted to women." So the standard response is, "Okay, so you'll marry a really pretty woman, and then, like, you'll see, it'll be okay." It doesn't work that way.
Isn't it beyond that, though? So I'm not sure whether it's kind of an anti-trans thing. It's more of, this is what we see an idyllic family to be.
Right.
And I think even beyond that, you know, it's issues with couples that struggle to have kids. It's issues with, you know, they don't decide to have kids. It's issues with
Jews of color. Anything that doesn't look
right,
able-bodied people,
right. Anything beyond that, and I have rants about intersectionality that is also problematic. So intersectionality, just in one sentence, is the idea that if you support one thing, you support all the rest. There are issues with that, but it kind of does.
Yeah, there's a way in which yeshivas really cater to, like, that top 1%. Like, the goal is really to try to produce the best rabbi and rabbinic leader. And so that looks like, in that world, like something very, 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 very specific.
So I'm still, I feel like we've covered it, but I'm still fascinated by this idea that a yeshiva is designed to make people think in a certain way. So, you know, and it is. And I think yeshivas will be quite open about that. And you've accepted that to a degree because you're here now with a beard and a hat, and, you know, but then you've also rejected part of that idea as well, in terms of you've gone, well, the logic that you've espoused here doesn't prevent me from advocating for trans rights.
That's correct. In fact, for me, motivates me, right? In other words, that same mentality. So,
how many others are there like you?
I think they're all in the closet. Yes, but it's true. So I guess this is what, I'll try to give this better language. When we talk about systems of oppression, there's a way in which Judaism sees equality as liberation, especially for those who are accustomed to discrimination. To say this differently, yeah, for those who are accustomed to discrimination, equality feels like liberation. There is a huge space, and really it's a power dynamic, that the yeshiva world hoards all sorts of assets in terms of knowledge, in terms of access, in terms of power, right? It's a theocracy. It's a top-down model. And so there's a way in which, especially after World War II, from those ashes, there was a fear, how are we ever going to rebuild? And so we're not going to be a light unto the nations. We're not even going to be a light unto the neighborhood, right? That's next to us. We're going to like hoard it, and we're going to focus, and we're going to hermetically seal it, and we're going to prevent. And so like we pushed pause. Like 1880 was a good year, and we pushed pause, and we want to get back to that space. It's reactionary, as so much of religion is. It's why we don't study prophets or Hebrew grammar because of the Enlightenment. And so at the intersection of tradition and innovation, there's a lot of tension. If you change the rules too much, it's a different game. If you don't adapt, no one's going to show up to play. And so, and this is the struggle that most movements have to varying degrees, right? If you're on the far left, there's, so the far right drew these lines with Sharpies, big, thick Sharpies, and you can't move them. The far left doesn't have them, right? So like today there's a new thing. Okay, so good, fantastic. It's all good. And it floats and it goes out and there's no tension.
Oh, I'm not sure I agree. I think the far left can be quite intolerant, actually.
It can be very intolerant, but I don't think it struggles with the intersection of tradition and innovation.
Okay,
we
fine.
Can innovate all that we want. Meaning, because we don't feel bound for them. Meaning, if you think of like the reform movement, the way it was originally about taking off, like you weren't allowed to wear a talis or tefillin. Like you needed to eat pork, right? There was no tension there. There was a jettison, you know? So,
but is that true?
I mean,
I'm not. I feel like there's the Orthodox rabbi coming out.
So, right. Look, some of my best friends are reform rabbis, right? So, but then the conservative movement, I think, struggles with this actually because of that space of wanting it both ways. There's some squiggly lines, right? They've redrawn lines around marriage between people of the same gender, but they haven't redrawn those lines around intermarriage, right? And if you want to have a posture of egalitarianism, so then how are you still holding by matrilineal descent if men and women are exactly the same with it? So like it's all I'm saying is it's not a judgment, it's just they're squiggly. In that space in particular, they're squiggly. So the far right drew the really permanent ones, the far left, maybe they're in pencil, whatever that is, and in the middle they're squiggly and they're actually like in tremendous tension often.
Oh, tell me about it.
Right. And it's a tricky place to be, you know? And because the world is changing so quickly, those bigger ships cannot steer fast enough to keep up. And so you have all of this kind of autonomous pop-up things, you know, Labshul and other things that are... The other things that we're acknowledging and observing, a lot of blending of things that never went together. There's queer Talmud, there's queer mikvah, there's things that never met. And so for me, I think pressing the pause button so it says, so it's play, is really just applying that tradition and that rabbinic methodology and sources to a topography that hasn't yet been acknowledged. So I think we're meant to live in present tense. I think that if we want the Torah to be alive, we need to allow it to have language to speak to the questions of today. So if you don't acknowledge the trans experience, so then you don't need to ask a new question, because of course we don't have gay people here. Of course not. And if they are, then they'll pray it away, or their reincarnation, and they're meant to suffer, whatever that is. But if you live in the world outside of the shtetl there, and you say, but one second, you know, a third of the people who have left ultra-Orthodoxy identify as LGBT. So
really?
Yeah, in America.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, like, do we want a LGBT-free space or not? Do we really want to purge Orthodoxy from all those people who aren't straight and cisgender? So if the answer is no, of course not, we want all the Jews to feel welcome, so then how do you make all the Jews feel welcome when you say that you're actually not as, right, in an equal way? So I think for me, to answer the question, it's not about changing the Torah in any level, but it's really giving it voice to answer the question in present tense.
Hmm. Wow. That feels very considered. Yeah.
Sorry for the pause before.
No. Just I suppose it was on a kind of logistical level. Like, do you conduct marriage ceremonies, or, you know, and...
Sure. Some of the practical logistical questions, right? A lot of the work for me is in minimizing whatever is at stake in answering the trans experience. So let's say, for example, you have a trans man getting an aliyah. So the person presents as masculine, they sit on the men's side of the mechitza, they were assigned female. So
without having to answer the meta question of does halacha see this person and at what point in the transition, because I don't think that's the right question to ask, because then we're just substituting the social construction of gender with a halachic construction, and the gender nonconforming space is growing and fewer people are having surgeries, and for some people the transition is just a haircut or just a name change or just a wardrobe change, or some, you know, and some for people it's hormones and some people it's surgery and some surgeries not others. And so one of the things that I learned really early on in this is that there's no trans community. Like, there's no Jewish community. We have a bunch of different Jews and everybody does their own thing. And I think that there are a lot of lessons that we, the cisgender community, can learn from the trans community that doesn't really exist, in that if we would take our religious identity as seriously and as constantly checking in as folks do with their gender identity, we wouldn't have assimilation, we wouldn't have the apathy, and we'd all know exactly who we are in the moment, whether we're cherry picking or not. We'd be really conscious and deliberate about it. The role of the rabbi, I think, is to help facilitate a healthy relationship with God. And when the rabbi takes up too much space, it's just crowded, right? Any space, really. The role that I have is to really empower individuals and give them the access to the information so that they, in the moment, can answer the question. So if a person says, "Rabbi, you don't understand, I can't live like this," God forbid, we should tell them that they have to die for it. And those questions are real. I mean, now in Lakewood, I'm sure we're popular for all the wrong reasons in the news, right? Measles and vaccines. The number that's being thrown out is that if there's a 1 in 1,000 chance that something is fatal, that's called pikuach nefesh. God forbid, within the trans community, among those who are not supported, it's almost 1 in 2. It's around 41% attempt suicide. So that's another example of like a social construction of, well, for measles, we care if it's 1 in 1,000. Mm. But if it's a person who's trans, even 1 in 2, like, it's not my problem.
I suppose that, like, I've had this conversation with, in fact, I won't give any more information as to who it was, but they come up with a line that you hear a lot, which is, you don't believe that people choose, you know, why would you choose to be trans? And I'm like, I don't, and I just responded with, I don't see it as a choice. It's just they are. I just didn't know how to respond. I didn't know how to kind of, because for me, it's like, well, it's weird. It's not something that I think about in terms of, what right do I have to tell somebody they're not who they think they are? Well, who the hell am I, right? I suppose, I feel like I'm not asking a question, but then I'm going to go on with the question. That is, what should someone like me do who I'm not an ally, but I'm passive?
Right. It's a wonderful question, and I so appreciate being invited to share thoughts on it. It's always easier to align with the one who's being oppressed than it is to be in opposition to the oppressor. So, for example, on a subway, you hear somebody getting up and preaching about the things that, at least in New York City, get preached about often, and they're rarely inclusive. People who think about this all the time have a very clear kind of set of guidelines that it's rarely successful to go up against the person because you don't know who they are and all the things. But to go and to make eye contact with a person who you feel might be suffering, right? If it's a person of color and that's what the rant's about, or somebody who's Muslim, to say, like, I'm not okay with this. Are you okay with this? And really to try to provide a safe space that you're not alone in this. And I want to also help validate your truth here, because, like, this is not okay. I'm not okay with this. This guy's a nutball. Let's say in a synagogue context, right? So the rabbi just gives a speech about earthquakes and tsunamis because of, you know, what happens at the Pride Parade, right? Which is what people talk about sometimes. So to say, like, that was super stupid, right? We've got scientists and nobody's done studies to figure out how many gay people walked holding hands vis-a-vis the number of earthquakes. This is just stupid made up stuff, right? Because that fear factor, you know, sells tickets. And the other thing is that creating strength in numbers, that you might be by yourself a voice where you don't feel strong enough, right, to go in the air or in that context. But my guess is that in your synagogue, there's probably a decent percentage of people who are in the same space of, like, they wouldn't be the one, but maybe with 9 other friends, they might be willing to create a space.
So basically what you're saying is gang up on the rabbi.
Absolutely. Look, I mean, you know, I've gotten fired, like, and it happened to be not because I'm a majority of people, right? It happened to be a minority of people. So I think that there's strength in that way. But gay straight alliances, I think, are really important. One way that I think about this, and I wrote about this, I write often and publish. I have a website, rabbimikemoskowitz.com. There's a resource section. So I wrote an article there, why I'm marching as an Orthodox rabbi with pride. So I grew up in Richmond, Virginia, which is the capital that was the capital of the Confederacy. And so there's another pride march where I come from. And now it's not just in the South. And when people who have more power than average and want more at the expense...
Sure. This might be an American thing that I don't know of. What is it, like white pride?
White pride, white power.
Wow. Yeah.
And growing up in the South, so we had racists in the KKK, but you couldn't be out as that because society was like not okay with it. You had to wear a hood. And now you don't need to wear a hood anymore. You can leave your KKK hood at home and go with a tiki torch and your khakis and looking all American and like in a new hipstery type way minus the beard. So there's been a massive shift. When we think about segregated spaces, I think the determining factor is whether or not we're segregating for equality or for inequality. So if you want to have, you know, let's say a Black caucus, right? But the goal is for equality. If you want to have a straight only space that there as an alliance to create equality. So I think those things are really good. When people who have more power and they want more, so I think that's what we find in Orthodoxy. I mean, I think that's where, you know, there's this fear of, you know, this makes us uncomfortable. So the people who have access to everywhere are saying, hey, you know, we don't really want to have to build a ramp for a wheelchair. Like, it makes us uncomfortable. Like, we don't want to see this. And when we talk about, and I mean, this has happened to me where the rabbi has said to me, listen, having a trans person here makes people uncomfortable. So people are the people who don't have to worry about having spaces where they're not allowed access.
Do you know what I do when they say that? I go, who? How many?
Yeah.
Oh, loads of people. How many? Two, three, four?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I think that when we talk about systems of oppression, that we need to recognize that Judaism and religion in general has so much power that not using it for good, I think, is itself a sin. I mean, in America in particular, during the civil rights movement, churches, Black churches in particular, were massive instruments of social change. And so if you have a rabbi who is willing to be political, but is on the wrong side of it, right? So I think that like it's really fair to name that and to perhaps to create a collective. Like, listen, I was at a meal today and the discussion was whether or not the rabbi would be allowed to come to Limud, right? And so the woman said, if we ask incoming rabbis, would you go? If they say no, they're not going to be our rabbi. So I think that there's power for people that doesn't ask of them to be the voice.
Right. Interesting. I like that. I did notice that you a little bit skirted around the reaction of other rabbis.
I can readdress it. There are people who absolutely think that I've been possessed. Like there's a relatively famous rabbi in America who says that I've been possessed. That's the answer to this.
Wait, yeah. Has that been published?
No.
Oh, fine.
No, that's not my problem.
That's a shame. You thought you could have said who it was.
He told a good friend of mine that I've been possessed. Like, that's the answer. Like, how do you explain this? I mean, he's possessed. Right?
I've got such a good idea who it is. I'm probably right.
I'll
as well.
Tell you after.
Yeah, please do. I look forward to it. Yeah.
There are those who have said to me things like, look, I'm not happy with what you're doing, but for the people that you're doing it for, I feel that they're lucky to have you doing this.
That's a really interesting way around.
And I think that that's a space that a lot of people are in because they recognize that there aren't people publicly doing this.
Right.
And because the rabbinate has taken such the wrong approach to this, the Rabbinical Council of America and right now doesn't have policies about conversions for trans folks, which is really it's legitimately complicated. Let's say you have a trans woman who did not have bottom surgery and isn't circumcised. So, and now wants to convert to Judaism, right? So is that body part specific? Is that gender specific? How do we hold gender-based spiritual practice? Like there are real consequences and Jewish identity, the stakes there are really high, obviously. The RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, which is a mainstream-ish, it's the largest group of Orthodox rabbis. I've been told by the head of it that about half of them are in some way supportive and the other half are in opposition. They don't make public statements because if they're quiet, nobody's going to leave. But if they make a statement in support, but I think that for the most part, they're good people and they want to do the right thing and they're not necessarily there yet. There's a huge age gap in terms of the way in which it skews for being supportive in opposition. Obviously, the younger rabbis, for the most part, all know people because there are trans people everywhere, whether you know about it or not. And the older ones, I think just the way in which this always works is that way. So there are rabbis who won't return my calls, who I am no longer consider them to be like in relationship. There are some that are fascinated by all of this and like want to hear, so what did you hear this week? And there's a way in which it's kind of a cerebral curiosity that almost borders on voyeurism in a way that's not healthy. Just to say this, you know, nobody's life is ever hypothetical. And very often rabbis, by the very nature of the conversation, speak about things like, well, what would be if there was a person who? And there is that person, right? And so part of, I think, my contribution to these conversations with other rabbis is to reiterate that, like, nobody's life is hypothetical. So you're talking about these people, but this isn't these people. It's Yanki, it's Rachel. Like, these are human beings, children of God. And if we want to have a relationship with God as a parent, like, we need to see all of God's children as our siblings. And I think rabbis need to be reminded about that, like, often. You know, and I mean, I wrote a different article about abortion. As a rule, Judaism is definitely pro-life, but sometimes it obligates an abortion. And if we want women to have access, then we need to be pro-choice beyond the other pieces. And so I was at a conference at Berkeley and I was presenting on how to kind of advance these type of ideas in very conservative spaces. And I think the most important thing is to make it personal, right? If Rachel needs an abortion, that's different than what happens if a woman, right? Mm. And so I think that the more trans folks that rabbis can meet, the more the rabbis are going to be in a better position. And it's hard and it's awkward to ask those who are already oppressed and marginalized to like dig deeper and to stand up. But I think that's the role that the rest of us have, is to creating a safe space for those voices and those stories to be told.
Or what they could do is listen to the Bagel podcast and we'll have more people on there.
That's right.
So actually, you know, I am being a bit flippant, but at the same time I'm being serious, yes, right? That this is an opportunity where if you aren't open to those voices, here's a place to hear them. One place.
Yes. One place, no, and it's not a small thing. So if you're trans, you're gender nonconforming, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Oy at bagelpodcast.com. Door is always open.
Fantastic.
One last question, sure. And you might not want me. Yeah, we'll see. What do your family think?
It's complicated, is the short of it. There are those that are supportive. There are those that...
Most of them are conservative, Masorti.
It's a mixture. My family's mixed. Some are observant, some aren't. The ones that are observant get hassled relatively frequently. What is he doing? And can't you tell him? Like, I've been called a Torah molester, all sorts of weird things.
Badges,
right. And the response of this is really important holy work. And also, I think that there's a relatively short window that has an expiration date, that 5 years from now, this is not going to be novel. 5 years from now, like, I'm not going to be on the fringe. This, I think, will be part of mainstream and dominant culture.
Even within Orthodox Judaism.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, like, the further you get, but the systems of deterrence, even like in the Haredi and the Hasidic world, right? Like, there's smartphones now, right? You have 13 kids. It's rare that all 13 stay in the fold, because getting married really young, not learning English, not going to college, you know, having babies really quickly, like, those things kept people in. But now everybody's got a sister or a brother or a sibling that's on the outside. To try to keep people in, as opposed to trying to create an environment that wants to attract people to be there, it's just not working in the same way. And people have access to information. And so these things are really complicated. And like, my family has people that are ultra, ultra, ultra Orthodox and completely secular, and we're gay and straight and all the things, and trans. One person, you know, is able to really influence many. And I think it's just a matter of time. I mean, I can tell you from my own experience as a rabbi, the baseline, certainly within the LGB community, of Orthodox, mainstream Orthodoxy has shifted. And even in yeshivish circles have shifted. The baseline was like, you had to move out. And now more and more people are even open to having their children and their partners come for Shabbos. Probably the most common question I get from parents about, you know, lesbian daughters is, you know, my daughter went off to seminary, she went off to college, and now she's gay and has a girlfriend. So the follow-up questions are really interesting. Like, is she going to get a haircut? Do I have to buy flannel? Like, what does all the stereotypical stuff mean? But the question is, like, she now wants to bring her girlfriend for Shabbos. Like, what's going to be? Can I do this? Am I allowed to? Which, like, do I have to sleep in different rooms? What am I going to tell the siblings? What about shidduchim? All the things. So the response I have is really consistent. Like, you know, is she still Shomer Shabbos? And they'll say, yeah, of course. So it's not a given. So I say, listen, you have a choice. You know, either you can have a lesbian daughter that's Shomer Shabbos, or you can have a lesbian daughter that's not Shomer Shabbos, right? So, like, the question is always, now what? Like, what does a win look like? And if you want to have a relationship with your kid, then, like, you need to recognize who your kid is. And I think more and more, even in Haredi spaces, parents are just, they already had one that, like, intermarried, or they had one that's no longer Shomer Shabbos, and, like, another one who wants to be Shomer Shabbos and, like, you know, raise a family and all the things, and just, okay, it happens to be they like this person and not this person. Like, I think more and more, and then, like, we'll see what happens over time if they start going to the ceremonies and all the things. But, you know, I think this moves in one direction. I think it's moving really quickly. And, you know, without having to change anything that's part of our tradition of what the Torah says or how we understand it, I think what we need to change is how we treat people.
What a perfect way to finish. Rabbi Moskowitz, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been a pleasure. It has been a pleasure.
It's a distinct honor and pleasure, and I so appreciate the invitation. And for folks in the LGBT community, reach out. Have your voice heard.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. Good times, man.
And that's that. Thanks again to Rabbi Moskowitz. Tune in next week for the final LGBT Bagel Bite with Alfie Ferguson. They're not an advocate or someone with something to sell. Just a person from the Jewish community living their life. Until next time, have a great week.